We're talking about a bill to increase access to dentists in rural areas. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Rural Track program at Marquette University School of Dentistry would focus a dental student's experience around a rural practice. It would encourage young dentists to settle in underserved areas of the state through a scholarship program. Do you live in a rural part of the state? Have you had to travel long distances to see a dentist? What strain does that have on your life? Are you a dentist who practices in a rural area? Share your experience at 800-642-1234. Patrick Teston is a Republican state senator who represents the 24th District that covers the cities of Stevens Point and Wisconsin Rapids in central Wisconsin. Senator Teston, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Great to be on.
So why is there a shortage of dentists in rural parts of Wisconsin? What does this shortage look like to you?
Well, right now we have about 38 counties in the state of Wisconsin that qualify as a health shortage professional area. And that's designated through the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. And so we have a huge quality lack of access and quality of access in many parts of the state. And so this legislation would create a new scholarship program for a rural track dentistry. So younger dentists who are currently in school right now could receive up to $75,000 per year, provided they, for every year they take the scholarship, they give back 18 months in one of these 38 counties where there is maybe, there could be one to zero dentists in that entire county. We want to make sure that more Wisconsinites have access to oral health care, because we know if you see a dentist on a regular basis, the likelihood that you're going to have other issues down the road, just because there are so many health systems connected to oral health, is going to decrease dramatically.
Okay, so this scholarship program would be, you said, up to $75,000 a year, and then the dentist has to work in one of these designated shortage areas. So for how long would it be? For about 6 years, 7 years? What would be the trade-off?
So if they qualify for the scholarship program for the 4 years that they are in dentistry school, you would be looking at 6 years that they would have to practice in a rural area. And the reason why we do this is that the odds are pretty good that if they move to a rural area and realize that they have a great client basis, that the likelihood that they are going to stay in that rural area is going to increase dramatically. I think there's been this thought process in a lot of different professions that the only way you can have a good client base and is to go and practice in places like Madison or Milwaukee or more populous areas. But in reality, there's plenty and ample opportunity in rural areas of the state where the cost of living is much lower. If you like to go out and recreate, there's a lot of opportunities there. And so we see this as a great way to entice younger professionals into the rural areas of the state.
Why do you and Representative Tony Kurtz think a scholarship program is the right approach here to really shore up this workforce challenge that you're seeing?
Well, I think this is just one avenue to approach. So you have seen a number of different proposals specifically for oral health that have been introduced, from dental therapy to expanded dental auxiliaries to now this scholarship program. So We're trying to provide as many opportunities as possible to increase the workforce shortage within the oral health care. And so this is just one tool in the toolbox that we see as a critical piece to help entice these professionals into underserved areas.
Talking with Patrick Teston, he is a Republican state senator from central Wisconsin and is launching a bill with Representative Tony Kurtz to increase rural Wisconsin's dental workforce. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Governor Evers' budget includes this proposal to expand the Seal a Smile program, which provides money to repay school loans for dentists practicing in rural areas and to expand grants to safety net clinics. Do you see your plan complementing the governor's, or would you rather invest in this rural dentistry track scholarship program?
I see this as an opportunity to build upon what the governor's put into his oral health care package within this proposed budget, which I fully support the expansion of the Seal a Smile program that has been very beneficial for a number of school districts where hygienists and dentists go into these rural schools and cap children's teeth. So that way it cuts down on the number of cavities that they have. And again, we know based on studies that one of the biggest issues that we face right now is that in underserved areas, when children can't get adequate access to oral health care, that compounds problems. And oftentimes they become issues that get neglected, and then they have to go into an emergency room setting where it's going to cost an arm and a leg. And oftentimes it's the taxpayers that have to foot the bill, because oftentimes this is a population that tends to be a little bit more on the poor side, and oftentimes the Medicaid population. So again, this is an opportunity for us to throw out a number of different proposals that we're going to take a multifaceted approach to address the shortage in rural areas.
Senator Teston, this bill is another in this series of bills that's being put forward as part of the Rural Wisconsin Initiative. What is the Rural Wisconsin Initiative? Who's involved in it?
So the Rural Wisconsin Initiative actually started a couple sessions ago within the state assembly, where a number of state representatives came together who represent fairly rural areas and really decided that we need to make rural Wisconsin a focus. And the primary focus is on things like education, workforce development, technology, and healthcare. And last session was my first session in the state Senate, and we expanded the Rural Wisconsin Initiative to include members of the state Senate, which I've been very happy to be a part of. And we're really trying to show that rural Wisconsin has a lot to offer for the state, and it's not necessarily our more populous areas. And so we're really trying to educate our colleagues. So right now, and for many years, some of the biggest battles that we face in Madison, it's not Republican versus Democrat, it's not liberal versus conservative, it's urban versus rural. And we're really trying to emphasize and highlight what rural Wisconsin brings to the table for our state's economy. And so by having a number of legislators in this coalition, it's helped us get a number of pieces of legislation passed and signed into law that have really benefited rural Wisconsin.
How do you know, what do you see as support for this dental track, rural dental track bill? Do you see fellow lawmakers on board? What does the prospects of this bill look like?
So we just released this, the LRB, just this week. And so it's out for co-sponsorship right now. So any member of the legislature can sign on to this if they want to support this and be a co-sponsor. And so our hope is that in the next week and a half, 2 weeks, that we are going to go around and talk to office and encourage our colleagues in both houses and on both sides of the aisle to sign on to this. Because healthcare, again, this is another one of those issues that's not a left or right issue. We want to make sure that we have the best health outcomes for all of our residents in the state. And so I'm confident we'll get bipartisan support, and we'll see where this goes. This will go through the regular legislative process. It will get referred to a committee, and then if we can get it voted out of the respective committee it gets assigned to, then we hope to get it scheduled for the floor.
Well, State Senator Teston, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Patrick Teston is a Republican state senator representing the 24th District, covering the cities of Stevens Point, Wisconsin Rapids, and Central Wisconsin. We've been talking about this proposal for a dental program at Marquette that would address a shortage of dentists in some rural parts of the state. Coming up next, income tax revenues in 41 states recently surpassed pre-recession peaks. We'll break down the data to find out what's behind the rise and how Wisconsin fared. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. A record number of states are in better financial health than they were before the Great Recession. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dozens of states collected more revenue last year than they did before the 2008 recession, even when you adjust for inflation. So we're finding out why that is and how Wisconsin did. What questions do you have about tax revenue fluctuations? Would you like a tax cut from Wisconsin's tax surplus, or do you think we should be more careful when it comes to making policy-based decisions on revenue projections. Join in at 800-642-1234. Liz Farmer is the public finance reporter for Governing Magazine. She covers state and local budgets as well as other public sector fiscal issues. And her recent piece is called State Tax Revenues Are Higher Than Ever, But Good Times May Not Last. Liz, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So last year, a record 41 states you found were able to collect tax revenues that surpassed the Great Recession peaks right before the Great Recession. What can we attribute this rise to?
So, this is the latest data coming from the Pew Charitable Trust. And generally, there's a couple of big things going on, and it pretty much relates to federal tax reform that was passed at the end of 2017. You have these sort of blanket things happening of, you know, a good stock market, a relatively stable economy. Those are the kinds of things that generally help push up income and sales taxes and help growth. And I think as we've seen, you know, overall the nation's growth was higher than expected last year. So all those things are kind of general things that move forward. But what really pushed a lot of places over the edge this past year was taxpayer behavior, particularly with income taxes and state and local taxes and how they paid them. And so when the federal tax reform somewhat unexpectedly capped the amount that we all can deduct from our federal income in state and local taxes that we pay, a lot of taxpayers at the end of 2017 prepaid as much in state and local taxes as they could, including income taxes, property taxes. So you had this huge push of filings going on in that time of the year. And then continuing on into 2018, you had some continued activity in terms of taxpayers cashing in on some capital gain stocks and things like that, some more income being taxes being declared than is typical. And so what's happening now is you've had this huge push. I mean, a lot of states have, including Wisconsin, end of the year in a surplus because they just had all this revenue that was somewhat unexpected. And so that helps states push forward, and many of them, now 41, a record high, have surpassed their pre-recession peaks. So that's the good news.
Yeah, and we'll get to the bad news here in a moment, as we always do. But Liz, so connect that for us. How do individual state tax rates then factor into the spending power of a state?
Yeah, that is a huge debate. But generally speaking, so, if I am declaring $80,000 in federal income, I live in New Jersey, I pay an average of $18,000 or even $20,000 in state and local taxes, and that's for most people who live in New Jersey who file their state and local taxes separately and declare them. That's the average of what they pay. It's one of the highest states. And so if I am a property owner earning $80,000 a year, I can immediately take off $20,000 from my income that I declare to the federal government. So now I'm only earning $60,000 a year, and then, you know, all the other deductions that I might want to do. So that lowers what I pay in federal taxes. It's kind of a perk. And so what that helps is when my taxes get raised in New Jersey, as they tend to do, it sort of softens the blow because that's money I get to deduct when I'm paying my taxes at the federal level. And then the argument goes, well, all these high-tax states are being subsidized by the federal government. The other argument is all these high-tax states have a lot of high-income earners, and generally speaking, taxpayers there pay more than their fair share for services than do taxpayers in lower-tax states. So you can argue it till you're blue in the face both ways.
Yeah, and so if coffers, though, are generally better off right now, but you're seeing income tax collections down, what does that then project about the near future in tax revenue?
Yeah, so what's happening now is 19 states going into tax season were not taking in what they expected to in terms of the income tax. And that means that a lot of people, when planning ahead for this current budget year, they knew that what happened last year was off, but they didn't know by how much. I mean, how much of this is just a one-time boon? How much of this is the actual economy doing well? So unfortunately, what's happened is, most states budgeted for less less income than they actually got last year, but they still missed the mark. I went ahead and got some more recent numbers from the Urban Institute. There's a researcher there, Lucy Dadian, who I also cite in the article. She sent me some more updated numbers, and so she says that today, with just 11 state data from 11 states, which isn't a lot, but it looks like states are starting to have a really good April tax season. So, and Wisconsin is one of those. So this may, a month from now, we could be saying, oh, everything's fine. Tax revenues are coming in as expected.
But there's still a little bit of panic right now. Talking with Liz Farmer, she's a public finance reporter at Governing Magazine, looking at tax revenues in 41 states recently surpassed pre-recession peaks, what that means across the country, what that means here in Wisconsin, your questions as well, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about tax revenue ups and downs? Would you like a tax cut from Wisconsin's tax surplus, or do you think we should be more careful when it comes to making policy-based decisions on revenue projections? Call in. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. So, Liz, let's look a little bit more closely at Wisconsin. And what does your research, when you break it down, how does it project on our state?
So Wisconsin is an interesting place. It is, because of its, relatively lower income tax rate compared with some other states, it doesn't swing up and down as much. I mean, if you look at this, at the numbers compared with the U.S. average and what Wisconsin went through in terms of revenues during and after the recession, I mean, certainly the state, was hurting, but it didn't drop as much. I mean, it suffered about a 5-7% loss in revenues following the recession, whereas the average was nearly 15%. So it didn't swing down as much, but consequently it hasn't swung up as much. I mean, it surpassed, the state began, kind of surpassed its pre-recession peak in terms of what it collects, actually in I think late 2013, early 14, and then there was that little stock market correction that we all went through, so things dropped again. And then it passed, it kind of made up for that loss again by mid-2016. But looking at where it's at today compared with the rest of states, you see this sort of interesting Wisconsin's, little graph line has certainly shot up.
Mm-hmm.
But it is about 7.5%, almost 8% above now what it was taking in to its pre-recession peak. So it's now, that includes inflation and everything.
So,
and then,
go ahead. No, go ahead.
Oh, and just nationally, we are looking at about 13%. So there's a big gap in terms of Wisconsin's recovery versus the national average.
Well, Liz, so Wisconsin yielded a surplus then in the last budget. Lawmakers have proposed that a tax cut is the way to go, giving back money to the middle class. What do we know about using surpluses to fund tax cuts?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think anyone in public policy who doesn't actually have to make these decisions would say that, don't use a one-time surplus for something that you're going to pay every single year. I mean, it's like if you get a bonus and then you decide to spend your entire bonus on a new car, but your bonus payment only covers the first year of payments. I mean, it would not make any sense. What are you going to do for the rest of those years? Surplus, kind of the same thing, but again, we're still in this place of not knowing, is this a real surplus? I mean, is this going to be how it's going to look for the next, few, however many years? Or was this a one-time deal? And so we still don't have that answer. So it's pretty dangerous to just make an assumption and then make public policy based on it and then lock future budgets into this decision when you don't have all the answers. On the other hand, lawmakers like to get reelected. People want a tax cut. So there's a lot of, of that going on, too.
And as we start to wrap up here, there's so much that is out of our control. There is the global economy, the stock market, the interest rates, trading, all of the push-pull of our economic system can impact state revenue streams. So is there any way that lawmakers can even have a real sound projection on revenue estimates in the future?
Not really. you know, I'd say ever since in the past few years, but particularly since the recession, it's been really, really difficult to predict with any kind of certainty what the economy is going to do. And so the thing is, everyone is in this boat, and states have different choices about how aggressive or how conservative they want to be. Wisconsin has generally been pretty conservative when it comes to fiscal policy, but there is a lot of pressure now. We are in the longest recovery period that we have ever had, or we're about to approach it. And it's been such a slow period. There's so much pressure to kind of to put funding back into places that had seen a loss of funding. And the problem is, we're starting to see all these nice shiny numbers, and everybody knows we are closer to the next recession now.
Liz, let's pause it right there. Thank you for joining us.
All right, thank you for having me.
Liz Farmer, public finance reporter for Governing Magazine. You hear her on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.
From NPR.
We're talking about what happens to the luxury homes owned by baby boomers once they need to downsize. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Baby boomers own 32 million homes and account for 2 out of 5 homeowners in our country. But with thousands of boomers winding down their years in the workforce, this question is, who will buy these massive homes? Gen Xers aren't exactly putting in offers. Are you part of the baby boomer generation? Did you build or buy a dream home, but then later had trouble selling it? Or did you hold off on selling your home during the recession in hopes the market would pick back up? Did you take a hit? We're at 800-642-1234. David Clark is a Marquette University economist. He's also served as a consultant to the Wisconsin Realtors Association for almost 20 years. Dave, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, it's good to be with you.
So the U.S. Census Bureau says aging baby boomers will trigger this exodus of older homeowners. How does this age group compare to Gen Xers and millennials when you look at the real estate market?
Well, in terms of the size of the baby boom population, they are right in at about 76 million people. The Gen Xers are at about 82 million, and the Gen Ys are about 73 million. So these are three relatively equally sized cohorts. You know, the baby boomers are getting to that stage of life. They're starting to move into that stage of life where the housing transitions start taking place as a result of health considerations, and so you know, when they get to the point where they need to sell those homes, you know, they're going to be looking for individuals or households trying to trade up. Unfortunately, a lot of the Gen Xers are kind of at that stage in life where their housing situations are set. It's not as though they wouldn't move up if they could. Their problem is the millennials, the Gen Ys, really have not jumped into this market in any substantial way. So, you know, the baby boomers find themselves in situations, especially those with more expensive homes, where there's lots of homes for sale, but not a lot of buyers.
So these baby boomers building their dream homes back in the day, maybe 10, 20 years ago, you know, why did that happen? Is it there this tendency to buy bigger homes if you can afford them?
Well, you know, I think one of the if we look back 15, 20 years, if we look at mortgage rates are relatively low.
Mm-hmm.
You know, housing values had continually gone up, and so I think a lot of them looked at this situation and said, well, this is a good financial investment. That is, you know, real estate has been rising in value for a long time. We'll continue to accumulate wealth by building this larger home, and then we can sell it when we get to that stage in life where we need to downsize and get a relatively strong kind of return on our investment. You know, the problem, of course, that they didn't anticipate was the financial crisis in the latter part of the 2000 decade, and you know, real estate lost value, and in some areas it lost a lot of value. Wisconsin, if we look at the peak to trough movement, once you control for the quality of the home, we lost about between 16% and 17% of that value from peak to trough. But there are parts of the country that there was significant declines. You know, the four states that are typically noted in terms of the biggest peak to trough decline was California, Arizona, Nevada, and Florida. And you know, those were places where they lost between 40% and 50% of the value from peak to trough.
Right. We still remember those images of Las Vegas.
And the foreclosures spike.
And so
you had all kinds of downward pressure on home prices. You know, and millennials kind of sat on the sidelines as they moved into that stage of life where they normally would have bought homes. And that was a rational thing to do. You know, number one, their financial circumstances weren't particularly favorable. You know, they were graduating from college. Those who went and got a college degree were graduating from college at exactly the wrong time. You know, the national unemployment rate peaked at just over 10%. They had relatively significant college debt, and so some of them simply weren't in a position to buy a home even as they got into their late 20s, early 30s, that time when people typically will buy homes. But even if they had the means to buy a home, why would you buy an asset that was still dropping in value? And prices really continued to drop until the early part of 2012, and then they started moving up, and they have essentially moved up from that point forward.
We're talking about the luxury home market. Who will buy homes owned by baby boomers? David Clark is a Marquette University economist. He's a consultant to the Wisconsin Realtors Association. Are you currently trying to sell your home? Have you been forced to make adjustments in price? Where are you in the selling process? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Ed from West Allis. Hi, Ed.
Well, I think when you talk about we being baby boomers, you have to remember what happened to us. We were the generation that got automated, that had Reaganomics, that had our plants under Mr. Reagan demolished, closed, and moved overseas. So those of us, if we had a home, had to work two to three jobs, and our spouses had to work a job also in order to maintain it. And then what happened was Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney in 2007 and 2008, when all the value in the house, the equity, we call it, was lost within a matter of 12 to 14 days.
Ed, I want David to jump in here because, you know, there is a lot of political history, too, that impacts the housing market.
There certainly is. And certainly public policy can play a role. You know, low mortgage rates are things that increase affordability. But, you know, we certainly went through a relatively long stretch where prices were rising at some relatively rapid rates. We saw a big run-up in prices between 2003 and 2007. And so that certainly made housing a bit less affordable. You know, those who owned homes were benefiting from the the rise in the value of that asset, and those who sold at the right time certainly did well. But there's no doubt that once the housing market turned south, and that was in about 2007, early part of latter part of 2006 into 2007, 2008, there were people who lost significant portions of their value. Again, Wisconsin certainly did not suffer to the extent that other parts of the country did, and part of that has to do with the fact that, you know, we don't have a lot of speculative buying and selling that's taking place in the Wisconsin market. You don't have a lot of people trying to flip homes. Those types of situations that makes our home values more. Certainly makes them a bit more stable than other parts of the country. But there's no doubt that we lost value. That's one of the reasons that the Obama administration was trying to stimulate the first-time buyer market. The first-time buyer market is actually a pretty big market when you look at the share of housing. It peaked at around 50% of buyers being first-time buyers, and that was in 2010. Once those first-time buyers started seeing declining values, they kind of pulled back. So that generates a bit of a ripple effect, and that's one of the things that affects the upper end of the housing market, and it certainly affects new construction as well.
David, go ahead. If you could put some numbers on this for us, price ranges in terms of what buyers are being attracted to and what's staying on the market longer.
Sure. So if you look at the state of Wisconsin, we'll focus on the most recent 12 months, and we'll look at various price ranges and evaluate the inventories associated with those price ranges. So if you want to look at the homes that are moving the quickest, they're those homes that are under $200,000.
Mm-hmm.
And we have two categories in that price range. You have those that are under $125,000. There's about 3.6 months of available supply if you look at the last 12 months. So what does that mean? Well, if you look at the average monthly sales over the last 12 months, and you look at the total number of homes that have been on the market, how many months would it take to liquidate that supply?
And we have to pause it right there with Marquette University economist David Clark. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. The number of older adults selling their homes will substantially increase over the next couple decades. We're talking about what that means as luxury home sales see the biggest slump in nearly a decade. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Have you downsized your living situation after your kids grew up, moved away? What was it like finding a smaller home opposed to a bigger one? Join in at 800-642-1234. David Clark is our guide. He's a Marquette University economist. David, as we were talking about house prices, we had to cut you short because of the break there.
Sure.
Where you were talking about homes at around the $200,000 mark, but you know, here we are talking about homes that are a half million plus. And where do you see some of the differences?
Well, so if you look at those higher priced homes, there's plenty of inventory. There's 10 and a half months of inventory. Usually we talk about the 6 month inventory level as being a balanced market. If you're above 6 months, you're in a buyer's market. That is, buyers have a heavy advantage because there's more homes for sale than there are buyers to buy them. If you are below 6 months, then it's a seller's market. The strongest seller's markets are those under 200,000. really the 350 to just under 500,000 range is a relatively balanced market. And then you've got 10.5 months of supply when you look at those that are over 500,000 in the state.
Let's jump in here. Let's take a call. Susan in Milwaukee. Susan, hi.
Hi there.
What's on your mind?
Well, I am a baby boomer. I actually downsized for other reasons back in 2005, sold a very big, relatively new home, bought a home in the city of Milwaukee. I was teaching for MPS at the time. Paid $185,000, which was $10,000 under what it was listed at. That house came back to last year. It was at $149,200, and they took $7,200 off of it this year, which I actually needed in my equity in order to do some improvements and whatnot. I have put $80,000 into that house with improvements and updates, and have had real estate agents actually tell neighbors that homes were worth $10,000 less as soon as you got north of one of the major east-west streets in Milwaukee, which is absurd. And it was like a big real estate company that made that statement. Had people down the street from me put a house on the market. The kids were marketing it as their mom's home. She was going into assisted living.
Susan, do you regret downsizing?
Was what was given as the first offer on the first day. I don't think real estate agents are working for people who have got under $200,000 homes.
Susan, I'm going to cut you short there. David Clark, what do you hear there? As Susan downsized, and then put a lot of money into making improvements on a home that is not seeing equity.
Yeah, that's a difficult situation. Obviously, when we buy homes, we look to enhance the values, and it sounds like Susan has made some significant investments. Without knowing exactly where the home is located and what the specific circumstances are in the neighborhood, it's difficult to say what might have caused those values to decline. Certainly, neighborhood characteristics, though, crime rates, those types of things can come into play. There are realtors that specialize in different price ranges of homes. I think the key to finding the right type of realtor is to find someone who really knows your neighborhood and is selling significant numbers of homes in those neighborhoods. The market can face challenges. You need a realtor who certainly knows the neighborhood and has a good network of buyers that they can try to find the right match for. I'm kind of going through the same situation with a parent's home. This is in another state, but they have gotten to that stage of life where selling the home was necessary. And while they took care of the home, things got dated. The value of their home was quite a bit lower than the newer homes in the community. And so we've had to make concessions as we move towards selling that home. So yeah. Anytime you have that, you have a generational shift out of housing, it's not uncommon for those homes to lose some value because the property's gotten, the property may be in good mechanical shape, but stylistically, older homes don't necessarily have all of the amenities,
all the bells and whistles,
current buyers are looking for. So,
yeah, and David, I often think about Toll Brothers as a bellwether for the luxury home market, since they're luxury home builders, but they're in the housing starts end of this, and it's different than when you're trying to unload a home that was designed, built to your every specification, and unloading a home that is built to your own needs and whims is probably more difficult than a home that wasn't. Is there anything to that?
Oh, certainly. What a realtor has to do is to find the right buyer to move into a particular home, and the more unique the home is, the smaller the pool of buyers who might be interested in buying those homes. You know, the best situation for a seller is to have multiple buyers who are in a bit of a bidding war for the property. That's tougher when you've got a unique property, a property that appeals to a much more narrow range of the buyer population. Those homes that were built for a specific person in mind may find it more difficult to sell them when that time comes, because the number of potential buyers is lower given the buyer preferences.
Let's bring in Dylan in Milwaukee very quickly. Dylan?
Yes, hey, good morning, guys. So I'm 29 years old, and being a young adult right now, I'm moving all over the country for better jobs and whatnot. And my question is that with millennials and whatnot growing, with population growing, within the next 20 years, do you see, like, the real estate game changing? A lot of times most people don't want to play this game with finding a realtor, going to counties that have better land value over property value, and just in general, it just seems to kind of be dying out for the younger culture and as population's growing in the future.
Thanks, Dylan. Very quickly, David Clark, your thoughts.
Well, I think the millennial population, and Dylan is in that population, you know, they are moving into owner occupied housing. Finally, the percentage of those individuals who are homeowners has been inching up over the last 3 to 4 years. The problem that they have is the entry points are pretty tight in terms of inventory. But it will improve. It'll improve because more baby boomers are going to be moving their homes onto the market. The supply will adjust, and that ought to bode well
for millennials.
For millennials, exactly.
David, thanks for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
David Clark is a Marquette University economist consultant for the Wisconsin Realtors Association. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.